We live, ladies and gentlemen, in an age of rockets, bombs, terrorists, and peace-shattering fears. God has spoken to us in predictive prophecy, not to satisfy our curiosity, but rather so that we might have the peace that he promised when he said, "My peace I'll give unto you," not like the world gives. Oftentimes of late I have been asked, is there any suggestion in Bible prophecy that the United States is going to be thrown over by some foreign country? May it be a coalition of the Russians and the Chinese or some such thing as that. Is there any such suggestion? And the answer is no, there is not. I said to you last night and will repeat again tonight, prophecy is history written in advance. It's God's pulling aside the drapery that shields the future and showing us a good bit of what is out there. On the other hand, history is the mirror reflection of prophecy. It is prophecy fulfilled. History, prophecy, prophecy, history always go together. And so we're going to be sharing night by night a good bit of history, world history, biblical history, and history of the United States as we get further on down the line. I asked you last night to read in preparation for this evening Daniel chapter 2. So turn there with me just now, if you will, please. Daniel chapter 2. Daniel is writing about 560 years before the birth of Jesus. And he's writing from Babylonian captivity. The wise men and ladies of Jerusalem and Judea have been taken way out some 500 miles east, across the burning sands, to the capital city of the world at that time, Babylon. You see, and some of you are going to find this interesting, King Nebuchadnezzar had married a girl from Beirut, Lebanon, and I told you last night that the area and the city of Beirut was once one of the most lovely in all of the world. Any of you ever been to Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada? Yeah, many, many of you have. The area of Beirut, Lebanon would have reminded you much of that. Beautiful, beautiful clear water, sandy beaches, and lovely trees and shrubberies that just come right down to the water's edge, and the great cedars of Lebanon up on the mountain sides. And so Nebuchadnezzar marries a girl from this environment and takes her 500 miles east, where there is hardly a hint of a rise. And as you can imagine, she is homesick. And so he builds for his bride in the center of downtown a mountain. And he covers over the mountain with greenery and shrubberies and trees. And from the backside of the mountain, there are men, slaves actually, who turn hand-turned pumps to force water up and over, and it spills and cascades down in waterfalls and gathers in pools at the front and the base of this mountain in the city. And then he hangs from the wall beautiful, beautiful gardens that are hand-watered and filled with oriental blossoms. It's in this environment now that Daniel, with his three Hebrew buddies, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, are made a prisoner. I'm going to begin to read and ask you please to follow Daniel chapter 2. And we're going to find here a resume of history that covers the period from Daniel, there those 560 or so years before the birth of Christ, right down to the very last hour on planet Earth when Jesus comes back on the rescue mission. I'm going to begin to read at verse 31, but first I'll give you a little further explanation regarding the setting. The king Nebuchadnezzar has conquered the world from the banks of the Ganges to the banks of the Nile. Everywhere that it's known that men are living in number, he has gone there with his armies. He's beaten up on them and brought back their treasures to his capital city and brought back with him the brightest minds, to include Daniel and his friends. One night, he goes to his bed with this burning question in his mind: what's going to happen? Will my accomplishments last indefinitely? Will my children's children sit upon my throne? What does the future hold? And then he fell into a troubled sleep, and during that night, he was given a dream. The dream consisted of a statue of a man. Unique it was. It had a head of gold and chest and arms of silver, and it had hips and a tummy that were of brass, and then it had legs of iron and feet, a strange mixture of mud and iron. Now he wakened the next morning, troubled. He knew that this dream had to do with this question, how long will my kingdom last? He rang his bell, and his chief servant called in all of the wise men. And when they were gathered, the king said, look, here's your mission today. I've had a dream. It's a very important dream. You tell me what I've seen and tell me what it means. Now the wise men got their heads together, and then their chief spokesperson says, Your Majesty, you tell us what you saw and we'll tell you what it means. Now the king was no dummy. He knew to the sure as he told them what he'd seen, they'd make something up. But there was more than that. Now he had a problem remembering the detail. And so he said, look, you're either going to tell me what I've seen and do it quickly, or you're all going to die. By the way, the Bible says that the majority of those wise men were the astrologers, you know? Guys that looked to the movements of the heavenly bodies and which sign was Capricorn as it was related to Sagittarius or Leo. And it was a bunch of junk then. It's a bunch of junk still to this very day. Didn't work then. It doesn't work now. And so if you folks are going to decide on the President's Day tomorrow whether you're going to go drifting down the Umpqua River and fish or you're going to do the little honeydews, my suggestion is that instead of you looking to the astrological signs, you do what Mama says. Yeah, you'll be way ahead of the game. Now, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were not there when the king made the demand, but now they were under the same sentence of death, and so they decided it was time for prayer meeting. They gathered themselves together and said, Lord, if it's your will, give us the dream and its interpretation. And then they put their heads to pillows and slept the sleep of weary children, slept without the aid of Somnex, Valium, or Librium. And during that second night, God gave to Daniel the same dream, but now with the interpretation. And so early in the morning, he goes running down to the king's quarter and says to the chief steward, I have the information. And he's ushered in to the presence of King Nebuchadnezzar. And he says, I have the information and its interpretation, sir, but don't give me the glory. Make sure that it all goes to my God. And then he tells him and shares with him this resume of history from his Nebuchadnezzar's time down to the very end. Let's read what Daniel says to the king. Verse 31 and following. You, king, looked and you saw a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before you, and the form thereof was terrible. Today we would say awesome. Some of the new translations put it that way. His form was awesome. For this image had a head of fine gold. Now, by the way, can't you just see King Nebuchadnezzar? He's saying, that's it, son. That's certainly the detail that I saw. Yeah, a head of gold. Go on, Daniel. Please, go on. And so Daniel goes on. The image had a head of gold, but it had a chest and arms of silver. And its belly and thighs were brass. The legs, however, were iron, and the feet a mixture of iron and clay. And then you saw a stone that was cut out without hands, smite this image upon the feet that were part iron and clay, and break them in pieces. And then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold, broken in pieces together, become like the chaff from the summer threshing floor. The wind blew them away, and no place was found for them. And that stone that struck the image became a great mountain, a mountain that filled the whole earth. Now, whom does the stone represent? Whom do you think? Jesus Christ, of course. That is why lustily we sing, Rock of Ages cleft for me. On Christ the solid rock I stand, all other ground is sinking sand. Yeah. This is the dream, he says. Verse 36, now I'll give you the interpretation. You, Mr. Nebuchadnezzar, you're a king of kings. The God of heaven has given you a kingdom and power and strength and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell or the beasts of the field graze, the fowls of the heavens fly, he's given them to your hand. He's made you ruler over all of them. You are the head of gold. Now here is the statue that symbolizes time from his Nebuchadnezzar's date right down to the end. And he's saying, look, sir, you are symbolized here by the most precious of metals or gems, the head of gold, and you're the brains of the outfit. You're the head, the grains. And can't you see Nebuchadnezzar kind of swell up? Huh? Yeah. All right. All right. But Daniel doesn't stop there. He continues on. Verse 39, after you, there's going to arise another kingdom. It'll be inferior. And then a third of brass, it'll bear rule over all of the earth. And finally a fourth, it'll be strong as iron. For as iron subdues and breaks all that before it, so it shall break and it'll bruise. Here was the king's answer. How long will my kingdom last? Will my children's children? No. No, you're going to be thrown over, but those that'll come after are going to be inferior. And then verse 41, then you saw the feet and the toes, a mixture of potter's clay and iron. Kingdoms after that are going to be divided and weakened. There'll be in some the strength of iron. You saw iron attempt to mix with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part iron and part clay, so shall kingdoms be strong and others broken and weakened. And then you saw this mixture as they attempted to mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they would not stick together, even as iron will not mix with clay. And I believe, by the way, that that symbol is speaking to the marrying and intermarrying of nobility. Mingle themselves with the seed of men. And you historians, of course, know that the Queen of Great Britain, Victoria, was the grandmother of every crown prince of Western Europe. That was the family way to try to hold things together. And it ended up like the Hatfields and McCoys, of course. It wouldn't work. God said it wouldn't work. And then it says, and in the days of those kings, the down in the feet and the toes, the very ends of the toes, as we come to the end of history, in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up his kingdom that will never be destroyed. And his kingdom will not be left to others, but it'll consume and brew and do away with all those before it. For as much as you saw that stone cut out of the mountain without hands, it'll break in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold. The great God has made known unto you, sir, what is going to come hereafter. The dream is certain, and the interpretation is sure. You can take it to the bank, sir. This is exactly what's going to happen. Prophecy, history written in advance. It's time now for a history lesson. You, sir, the head of gold. Nebuchadnezzar's great Babylonian empire. But it would not last forever. After that, there came a division. The Medes and the Persians, one much stronger than the other, by the way, maybe because he was right-handed, symbolized by the arms and the chest of silver. Inferior, and yet quite a power as well. That one wouldn't last eternally. There would come a third great kingdom, a kingdom represented in the statue as brass, a tummy and hips of brass. And that is a reference because we know from history now certainly that it was the Grecian Empire, not Hellenistic Greece, but that prior to it, the Greece of Alexander. And by the way, if you haven't read a biography or two of Alexander the Great, you really need to do it. He was another guy with terrible ambition. There's some folks on the scene of world history today that remind me of Alexander. From the time he was a teenager, he wanted to conquer the world. And by the time he was 20 or 22 years of age, he had pretty much done that. He'd beaten up on everybody and some in remarkable battles, oft times. And when he was hardly out of his 20s, there was no one much to beat up on, and so he began to drink. Now, some will tell you, well, he contracted some disease. Yeah, it was alcoholism. He drank himself to death. It was Alexander. His kingdom of brass would not last forever. There would come a fourth great world empire, symbolized by legs of iron. We still today talk about the iron monarchy of Rome, ancient Rome. It wouldn't last eternally. There would then come multiples, divisions, symbolized by the feet and the toes, a mixture of iron and mud or potter's clay. And when you study history, ladies and gentlemen, you discover that at the fall of the Roman Empire, looking at the broad picture, now this didn't happen in days or weeks, but when you see the broad picture, you see that there were 10 great powers that emerged at the fall of the Roman Empire. Many of them are still on the scene today. The Angles and the Saxons in Great Britain. The English and the Alemans, that's Germany. And the Franks, that's France. The Suevi, that is Portugal and Spain. And right on down the line till there were 10 toes. Now God says, in the days of these multiple divisions, then Jesus Christ is going to come. And he's going to set up his eternal kingdom that'll not be left to others, and it's never going to be thrown down. Now, there would be many attempts to try to put it all back together again under one concerted power and regime. But God had said through Daniel and other places that it would not work. Noble efforts, wars, dictatorships, military alliances, the shedding of the blood of millions and the spending of multiplied millions of dollars. We talk at length tonight about Charlemagne or Charles the Great. He fought for 50 years and he came close. But shortly after he died, it all fell apart. And then Charles the Fifth. After him, Louis XIV of France. One night perhaps I'll take you to the Palace of Versailles, much of it built at the command of Louis XIV. And there are three main avenues. One comes right to the center of the gate, and two others at a 45-degree angle. And they were designed by the king, Louis XIV, to represent the rays of the sun. And he called himself the Sun King and encouraged his people to worship him as the sun god. And many did. He was in battle nearly all of his life. Seven horses were killed beneath him. He hardly received a scratch. And indeed, the folks came to think he was godlike and indestructible. He died in his bed. And I've been in his bedroom. And beside his bed, he died at about age 70 in the Palace of Versailles. He couldn't put it together, but he'd not be the last to try. There would come Napoleon Bonaparte. Waterloo, Waterloo, sang Stonewall Jackson. Where will you meet your Waterloo? Little Napoleon of France tried to conquer the world but lost his pants. Where will you meet your Waterloo? I didn't say it was Shakespeare. It's country, all right? I mean, it could have originated in Idaho somewhere. Yeah, Napoleon. I not long ago walked the battlefield of Waterloo. They have left it, ladies and gentlemen, much as it was at the time of the bloodshed, with one exception. In the center of the battlefield now, there is a great pyramid that requires your climbing up about 350 feet. The pyramid was made by gathering off of the battlefield the junk of the war. All the old war machinery and guns and wagons and the bloated bodies of horses and men, put them together in a common grave, covered it over with earth. You climb to the top, which has a level place, and you can put quarters in one of those telescopes, and you can look the scenery over, and you'll see a sign that says, the Duke of Wellington came from over there, and Blücher was here, and Grouchy was over there, and Napoleon came from here. Now, shortly before Look magazine went defunct, it did a computer study of the Battle of Waterloo, put in all of the information. How many did Blücher have? How many Grouchy? What were their positions on the battlefield? How many soldiers? How many horses? How many big guns? They fed the computer the information and then finally asked it this question: who will win the Battle of Waterloo? And they punched the enter button, and the computer in milliseconds searched its brain, and then there came on the screen a readout that said, Napoleon cannot fail. You see, these men were not defeated militarily. They were simply attempting to do that which God said could not be done. They will not cleave one to another. And then we're going to come to our own lifetime, many of us. I'm going to talk to you about Adolf Hitler, whom I believe to be the greatest warlord, certainly in modern times. We're still learning about him. His panzer legions swept across Europe, took Norway, Denmark, Holland, Belgium, France fell when he skirted the Maginot Line, and moved east, Czechoslovakia, Romania, and Austria. Hitler had conquered all of Europe from the Pyrenees to the Arctic. All of that Nebuchadnezzar and others had had before him, with one little exception of the 10 toes. 9 of the toes he had under his command, one exception, the Angles and the Saxons, the islands of Great Britain. On a clear day, he could stand on the shores of the continent of England and see the white cliffs of Dover, just as we saw them in our travel tonight. In his book, Mein Kampf, he'd stated his plan. I shall build an empire that shall last the Third Reich 1,000 years, exactly so. His plan, his announcement was to take England. I'm going to suggest to you that had he been successful, you and I would be able to speak the German language. It might not be our mother tongue, but I'm certain we'd be conversant in the German language had he been successful in taking Great Britain. You say, why and how so? The propaganda minister, Mr. Goebbels, of Germany, was raging across Radio Europe that the Germans were just on the verge of developing a great super weapon that would change the face of mankind. Now, the Allies, United States and Great Britain, France, thought it was just a lot of happy talk to bolster the sagging morale of the German soldiers and the Nazis. Not so. Not so. Strange as it may seem, she was an Austrian Jewess living in a little town on the German-Belgian border called Peenemünde. And she was putting together an atomic bomb. She had the heavy water. She had the enrichment of uranium. She had it all there. She was only just weeks away of completion. Simultaneous to this, there was a rocket scientist by the name of Wernher von Braun who had developed a couple of rockets. First, the V-1, which was more a flying bomb. And you, by the way, can see these at the Washington Institution of Technology, Washington, D.C. I've seen them so many times. A flying bomb. It could cross the channel and drop its load, but not with pinpoint accuracy. But within a few months, he had developed the V-2, which was indeed a rocket with precision. And by 1940, he was dropping those rockets with their loads on the industrialized cities, not only London, but Birmingham, Bristol, and many others. And the younger folks had taken their children, if you remember the history, some of you may have lived it, they had taken their children into the countryside and turned them over to strangers they didn't know at all. And then the parents, mom and dad, went back into the city of London and built jeeps and built tanks and built guns. I believe that had the Germans put an atomic warhead atop one or two of those missiles, and they dropped that atomic bomb on London and maybe another city or two, the British would have signed unconditional surrender, and then Hitler would have chosen an American city, maybe New York or another, to be the Hiroshima, the Nagasaki, and we would have signed surrender, and he would have ruled the world. God's hand prevented Hitler from ruling the world. And I'm going to share with you now what I believe are absolute miracles that had to do with that prevention. Number one, the miracle of Dunkirk. I lived it. Dunkirk is a little town on the French and Belgian borders. The King of Belgium saw the Panzer Legions and the tanks coming nearer and nearer and nearer, and he sent out an SOS to the Allies. Help! The United States was not in a declared situation yet. We were sending some equipment over, but we had not joined a declaration of war. And so the French and the English sent across some 350,000 soldiers to stand in a perimeter around the nation of Belgium. And the German armies were still miles away when the King of Belgium surrendered. He said, have the place. Now this finds 250 soldiers in a pincers movement. They did an about-face and double-timed it back to the port of Dunkirk and stood with their faces looking at the angry sea and coming nearer and nearer their backside, the German armies. It was their hope that the British could come across the water with one or two troop ships and take off perhaps as many as 35,000 of those stranded men, but still it would be a great slaughter. The waters of the Channel I mentioned during the travelogue are some of the most violent in the world. They are most violent during the month of June, and this was June of 1940. What do you suppose happened? For the first time in the memory of man, the waters of the Channel in June of 40 went as flat as this floor. And with troop ships, yes, and with several trips, and with pleasure craft and fishing boats, the British came across and took off load after load after load after load and took them over to Great Britain. They took off not 35,000, but 335,000 men. How do I know God is alive? I saw God in June of 1940 saying again to the seas, "Peace be still, they shall not cleave one to another." But Hitler wouldn't give up. It's September now of 40. Under the influence of the autumnal equinox and the harvest moon, the waters traditionally become most calm. And so he loaded his troop ships. He loaded the barges with the tanks and the jeeps and the big guns and started out across a peaceful channel to make a land invasion at Dover and Plymouth and elsewhere. They got out into the middle of the channel and for the first time ever noted, there came suddenly and with violence a horrific wind, a wind so great that it began to tip the barges and the tanks and the jeeps began to slip off into the ocean. And the commander of the Navy gave the command, turn back as soon as you can. And when they caught a right wave, they turned back and went again to the ports along the continent of Europe to drop the anchor and wait out the storm. And while they were there pulling at the anchor, the British bombers flew across the channel and blew the Navy away. How do I know God is alive? I saw God raising a storm again on the English Channel. God said, "They shall not cleave one to another." And finally, the Battle of Britain. By mid-41, Hitler's Luftwaffe, his air force, was crossing the channel and dropping bombs on those major cities. I believe that God had put Winston Churchill, who, by the way, was living at number 40 Downing Street, where we visited tonight, I believe God put him in that place at just the right time. For he was a man of iron will. You ought to read a couple of books about him. He was really a remarkable guy. Had flaming red hair and the personality of the little kids with red hair. He was always into mischief. His mother was a native of the United States of America. And his daddy was a government official with Great Britain. And he was left in boarding schools from his early years of schooling. He was fascinated with explosives. Winnie Churchill, at age 11, went into the chemistry department of the boarding school, a high school portion of it, with a friend, and tinkered around with explosives. Next door, there was an old house that some said was haunted, a 2- or 3-story house. And so these boys with curiosity went into the house, and in the basement, they found a tunnel, and they went back in the tunnel. Surely there was buried treasure. They got back only just a few yards, and it was blocked off. And so they said, there must be an exit somewhere, and in the back somewhere, they found a hole in the exit. And they went to where it was blocked off again. Not so much of a blockage. So they go back to the chemistry department and hollow out a pumpkin and put in there the explosive and make a bomb and put a fairly long fuse with it, lit the fuse, tried to get out the exit, and the neighbor woman who was watching and heard the explosion said, "I saw a little fat red-headed boy go about 11 feet in the air and come down, bounce twice." Winston Churchill was now in charge. We shall never give up. Never shall we give up. We shall fight on the land. We shall fight on the seas. We shall fight in the air, but never give up. And one afternoon, he and the company of his daughter-in-law, who later married Avril Harriman, who developed Sun Valley Ski Resort, where I was born. She went down with Winston Churchill to the bunker where Air Vice Marshal Park was watching a radar screen whose little blips represented the incoming bombers. Time and again, Vice Marshal Park got on the microphone and gave the command that sent those pilots, the Americans many, Canadians some, English very many. They ran out onto the tarmac and climbed into the cockpits of the planes whose engines were running 24 hours a day, and they flew out over the channel to shoot down the bombers or at least turn them back. Time and again, the order was given, again and again. And finally, Winston Churchill said, "Sir Park, how many have we left?" And with somber tone and solemn face, Vice Marshal Park turned and he said, "Mr. Churchill, sir, I'm sorry to say, I've ordered in our last." And they watched the radar screen for the next wave of bombers that would find the cities totally and completely defenseless. And as usual, it was the unusual. They never came. The Germans, too, had put in their last. And it was after this experience, and on the way back to number 10 Downing Street, Winston Churchill took pen and paper in hand, and speaking and thinking of those pilots that had flown the missions around the clock, he penned these words, now immortal: "Never in the field of human conflict have so many owed so much to so few. How do I know God is alive? I saw God at the Battle of Britain. God said they shall not cleave one to another. The next kingdom, the next great earthly kingdom of one government is going to be the kingdom of our Lord, our Savior, Jesus Christ. Let it come soon." I don't know about you folks, but I've enjoyed about all I can stand. My little granddaughter, Walla Walla, said that girl was my best friend. Oh, those grieving parents. I saw today the casket that the school Walla Walla woodworking shop parents said she was a simple girl, just wanted it plain and simple, real. She was a rock climber. So they made for her a very pretty wood casket. And for handles, put rock climbing ropes. There are days and times when we wonder how much more we can take. He that shall come will come and will not tarry. In the middle of a troubled night, a man began to doubt. Put his doubts to pen and pencil, paper, and he asked, "Does Jesus care?" "When my heart is pained too deeply for mirth or song. The cares distress and the burdens press, and the nights are weary and long. And then he answered, "Oh, yes, he cares. I know he cares. His heart is touched with my grief. And when the days are weary and the long nights dreary, I know that Jesus cares." 2,000 years ago, three crosses were raised on Calvary's Hill. On the right-hand side was a man paying for his crimes and sins, and on the left still another in the same condition. In the center was one who was dying for mine. These men knew that they were at the end of it. There was nothing they could do to change their fate. Nails in their hands and feet, unable to swat a fly. However, the one on the right hand recognized that in the person of he who hung in the middle, there was hope for today and tomorrow and forever. And so he turned and prayed, "Dear Jesus, remember me when you come as king." Now here we are, ladies and gentlemen, to a large degree in the same sort of a situation. We're at the end, and we're not going to change that. Regardless of who's voted into office in Oregon or in Washington, D.C., that is going to change very, very little. Our only solution is the coming of Jesus. Paul called it the blessed hope. I say tonight, it's the only hope. And so as we conclude, I wonder if you wouldn't like to join me in the prayer of the thief on the right-hand side. "Lord, remember me when you come as king." Just raise your hand. God sees your hand, knows your heart. Father in heaven, see us. Know us better than we know ourselves. Help us to look eagerly toward the second coming. Help us to take every advantage of these times of preparation to know you and your word better. Bless every home here again tonight, I ask and pray. And the children's children who are not here. There are some of our loved ones, husbands, wives, some of our children who aren't yet ready. Plead with them. Don't let them have rest until they give their hearts and lives to you. But in spite of that, please, please, don't put off your coming. Even so, come, Lord Jesus. Amen. Till tomorrow night, drive carefully. When you ride and drive, wear your seat belts tightly. Remember, Lyle believes in you. Good night. I'll see you tomorrow. Good night.